The guy's already throwing fists in the chat. But wait, oh, man. There's more. Hi. Hi, everybody. Hi, Dr. Nick. Of course, there's a pregame. There's always a pregame.
We were just pregaming without you guys.
Yeah. Oh, you didn't hear about the pregame? You didn't get the invite? How's the weather like right now, Daniel? You were saying that there's the hot summer and the wet summer. Where are you at right now?
Yeah, this is the wet season. So basically about between 1 and 3, generally it'll start raining and it'll just keep raining and keep raining and keep raining. And sometimes you get lightning and thunder and sometimes you don't. But if you're a local, you just learn that you don't plan to be outside walking at about 3 a.m. at this time of year because it's a very high point. You're going to get ready. And there's like these amazing storm drains and monsoon level gutters everywhere. So imagine like a regular street and then you've got a pavement, but half the pavement's been cut in half to allow room for the stormwater passage. And then the rest of the pavement, people just kind of, you know, have very little space.
Along.
So you take the choice between either just waiting as people are passing or just walking in the stormwater drain. So there's just all these little things to get used to. But it's really fun. I'm enjoying it here.
It sounds like a warmer version of Seattle.
Yeah.
I've only been to Seattle once. No, I have to say, when it is fine, it's beautiful. Like for 5 months of the year, you won't see virtually any rain at all. So then it turns into the complete opposite. But it's warm all the time. It's always just a nice temperature. It's hardly ever too hot, hardly ever too cold. And that's because even though it's in the tropics, where I am, it's at altitude. So it just takes a little bit of that tropical heat off it. So it's a nice combination.
So you said it's typically raining from 1 a.m. to 3 a.m. So did you find that out yourself? Or are you?
You found that out.
Oh, okay.
Walking outside and getting wet. In the afternoon.
Okay. I was about to say, are you typically somebody that's up at 3 a.m.? Because that's like a pretty rare time for somebody to realize that their schedule is being impeded.
And for those of you that weren't in the pre-pregame, losers, you may not realize, yes, Daniel has, you know, a New Zealand accent, but that is not the environment that he's talking about right now. He may not want to disclose live while we're at, but he's in the tropics.
Yeah.
It's around the equator somewhere.
Happy to disclose. Yeah. I think it's about 11 degrees north, something like that. So yeah, it's pretty tropical.
Nice.
I always picture New Zealand being more tropical, but maybe that's just like the images you see, you just picture that, but it's, I guess, further south. So it's.
Yeah. Think about like maybe Rome. So a city like that, it's Mediterranean climate.
Okay.
Which means it's beautiful for part of the year. And then it's just kind of cold and damp for the rest of the year.
My only real knowledge comes from, I'm currently watching, what is it?
Lord of the Rings?
Is it called? No, it's Surviving New Zealand, I guess is what it's called. Okay. And these people, like teams of two are like racing against these other teams. They'll like multi-day like race. I think the whole race is like 40 days. And they have to meet like certain checkpoints. But I mean, it looks beautiful.
And the cool thing is it's such a small country that you will have, like, it probably has no more diversity than, say, the US, but it's packed into an area the size of Japan, right? So it's super diverse. You can drive for a day and you'll see something that looks like a desert, then something that looks like the Grand Canyon, then something that looks like some snowy peaks, then some, like, extreme rainforest, and then a beach, and then some farmland. And you'll see it all just boom, boom, boom as you cross a mountain range. So that's one of the things that's pretty cool about it. Yeah, and it's great for extreme sport. Like if you like bungee jumping and whitewater rafting and just getting muddy and dirty, trekking over the country, seeing, you know, amazing scenery, it's just, it's an amazing place.
All right, it's going on the bucket list.
Were you born there?
I was born in England, but I've spent most of my life in New Zealand.
So you like England, New Zealand, and then now where are you? You've been all over the place.
Yeah. Stayed put in New Zealand for a very long time. Yeah. It's like the meat and the sandwich, but most of the meat and the sandwich by far was New Zealand. A little bit of time in Australia.
I was going to joke and say it's basically the same thing, but that might be offensive to Kiwis. I'm not sure.
I'm not offended by it. Some might be. It's kind of like saying that Canada and the US are the same thing, I guess, if you want a parallel. It may be offensive to certain.
How Canada. Dare you, sir? How dare you?
But from my point of view, it's like you got to look at it from the outside. I mean, as a New Zealander, of course, we see all the differences between us and Australians, right?
Yeah.
Someone from outside is just going to say, oh, your accents sound almost identical and your culture seems pretty much the same and you seem to have similar personalities. And
That's very much how it's really like with Canadians.
Yeah, you know, that's right. From the outside, all similar, but from the inside, you see all the nuances and the differences, right?
Yeah.
So on that topic, is it like a real thing that Australians will like tell tourists that drop bears are a real danger? Because I know what they are.
Drop bears? what is a drop bear?
So,
the reason
why I asked is because I wanted to know if it's a real thing that gets said or if it's just something that some local myth that spreads around talks. So like a buddy of mine lived down in Australia for a while and he said that they would tell all the tourists or the new people coming through to beware of drop bears, and they would tell people they have to worry about them like dropping down on them from the trees and scratching them up, and because they're koalas, they just don't refer to them as drop bears.
Yeah, koalas are kind of endangered a little bit, but they don't drop out of trees. Illegal. So, yeah, it's some Australians. That's an Australian sense of humor.
I like it.
mate, you gotta watch out for these drop bears. You know, make sure they don't fall on you, because you just fall out of the tree. You might see them coming, then they'll fall and they'll hit you on the head.
It's so funny to listen to somebody with a New Zealand accent do a Australian accent, because like to us it's just about the same thing, but it's like there's enough of a change there where we can tell you're trying to do an accent. That's pretty hilarious.
Yeah,
it's like a southern drawl.
Yeah
a bit more twang, a bit more nasal. Us we don't like to, you know, for us, talking is something to be minimized before you get back to watching rugby and drinking beer. So we don't like to use our mouths more than we have to. So it's like, yeah, g'day, how's it going? You're right. Yeah, story. Yeah, good one, mate.
Yeah, jog on.
Yeah, good. How you going? Yeah, good. Yeah, I saw you went at the game the other day. Oh, yeah, no. But I've had to learn that if I speak that way in the United States, no one will understand me. So, and it's funny because I've seen interviews of New Zealanders being interviewed by people in the US. And they'll have subtitles at the bottom. So I don't want to be that guy that you have to sub. I mean, of course, you're welcome to put words, but I don't want it to be required because that's the only way people can understand me. So I've had to, everywhere I go, I kind of adapt a little bit. So because if I spoke in a completely New Zealand accent, it would be harder to understand. And the other thing is we tend to speak pretty fast. So I've had to slow down my speech as well. Someone was saying they were watching this. Yeah, someone was like, even when I thought I was slowing it down, apparently it wasn't enough because you know how on YouTube you get all these comments and people leave these comments and most of them are nice and gracious and every once in a while there's a little bit. Yeah, so one of the people said, one of the great things about listening to Daniel is I didn't have to put him on double speed.
Jordan should be one to explicitly appreciate that.
And also said, like all Kiwis. So apparently we're known for speaking pretty fast, so I've had to try and slow it down.
Okay, like, this might be really douchey of me, but, like, could you give me an example? Like, say something and, like you're ungoverned New Zealand.
Take the governor off.
Yeah, take the governor off. Like, I don't understand just how, like, just what this is like. I've never experienced it before.
Yeah, sure. Well, mine's, I'll have to kind of ham it up a little bit because I haven't got a completely New Zealand accent because I had a father from the UK, so mine's pretty mild. But if I do one that some of my friends might speak, it would literally be, "Oh, so it's really good. Yeah, so I was at the game the other day. It was a pretty good game. Yeah, how do you do? Yeah, it was right. Yeah, that's the one. So I'm looking forward to the show. Should be a regular show. Yeah, how you going, Mike? You good? You're right? That's the story. Yeah, good man.
Dang,
good man.
Okay.
Yeah, you good?
It's very rapid ADD with no facilitation of dead space in between.
Not a lot of tonality, not a lot of movement of the lips. Like I say, we don't place a strong emphasis on communication skills as a nation, rightly or wrongly, probably wrongly.
Ritalin hasn't made it over to New Zealand yet. Maybe that's the issue.
I know Ritalin has made it over, but I don't think we need it.
All right. Let's do this intro.
Let's do the intro.
What is up, everybody? This is Bitcoin Veterans. We're Bitcoiners. We're veterans. Pretty self-explanatory. Our guest tonight is Daniel Batten. Daniel is an author, an acclaimed ESG analyst, a tech investor, entrepreneur, and coach. He's just a jack of all trades, apparently. He's most widely known for his groundbreaking independent analysis of Bitcoin's environmental impact, which has been recognized as helping Bitcoin become more widely accepted as a positive for the environment. He has run two climate tech funds and is currently establishing a third. And Daniel's recent statements have shed light on Bitcoin's unmatched sustainability, challenging conventional norms. And we love doing that around here. We love challenging conventional norms. So Daniel, welcome.
Hey, thanks, man. It's great to be on here.
So I want to kind of dig into some of this, like the statements and stuff that, you know, or you're getting all this acclaim for, that's really kind of recognized for. Can you kind of let the listeners know, like, what is it? What's so groundbreaking? What norms are you challenging here?
I think other people have said those things. I mean, for me, I never really set out to do anything groundbreaking, and it's not the way I'd describe it myself. Really, all I wanted to do is tell the truth. And when I started to dig into Bitcoin, and particularly the subject of Bitcoin and energy, I realized pretty fast that it was a subject where the truth had not been told widely. And Bitcoin has a really tremendous story when it comes to its energy story, its environmental story, and also its social impact story. But the story was not being told based on the data. The story was being told based on people's bad data, people's misunderstandings, or in some cases, people with vested interests in Bitcoin not succeeding. So really all I set out to do was some pretty neutral analysis to say, hey, where is the truth? What's the real story about Bitcoin, its environmental impact, its social impact, and how it can help with energy security? What's its impact on grids? Does it destabilize them? Does it stabilize them? Does it bring prices down? Does it bring prices up for residential users? I just wanted to answer these basic questions. So for me, there was no big deal. I just wanted to apply my analyst hat and do some good independent research. And to my surprise, it seemed to be pretty valuable to some other people as well. I was as surprised as anyone because really I did it for myself. I didn't really do it for anyone. I just wanted to know some answers for myself because coming at it from the lens of someone who's used to investing in clean tech or climate tech, I had different perspectives, and I had people who were in the environmental community who said, Bitcoin's terrible for the environment. And then I had friends in the Bitcoin community who said, Bitcoin's great for the environment. And I was like, guys, you can't both be right. So I'm not going to listen to either of you. I'm going to put everything to one side. I'm just going to do my own research and see what I find. And it was sheer intellectual curiosity to find what the source of truth was. I didn't have any ideas of what I would find. It was just purely for myself. And then I published that research. And then a whole bunch of other people said, this is awesome. Can you do more?
So if you don't mind, Daniel, so like I listened to a couple of your last pods over the last couple of months. Could you like go before we go into like that specific Bitcoin research that like helped you kind of like really explode in your popularity in the community? Like, how did you get into the clean tech investing to begin with?
Oh, man. So growing up in New Zealand and being in a small rural community when I was growing up, it goes right back to the beginning where there was a landfill proposed in our, and landfills feature on in my work as well. But anyway, there was a landfill proposed and the community got up in arms and they said, this is going to be terrible. It's going to poison the ground supply of water. It's going to be bad for the lagoons that kids like me swim in, because I was 4 years old at the time. I can remember that time like it was yesterday, even though I was 4 years old, because I remember a community of people who felt like their community, everything they held dear, was under attack, and they fought against this and they won. And that showed me how a community of people could get together and they could stand up for their local environment and do something really strong. So that kind of led to me taking a lot of part in different environmental actions over many, many years to protect the local environment. So it was always part of my value set. My mother was a strong environmentalist, and she really brought me up in that same way. And with that very strong love of nature as well. And I was even part of Greenpeace. I was a volunteer for them. I did volunteer actions for them and all sorts of things. And then at some point I realized, you know what? I think I can be more effective rather than complaining about what is wrong than finding solutions to what could be. And at the same time, I was getting into the technology sector. I'd started a technology company. It was the third different technology company I'd been part of. And I thought, well, what if we could combine the two? What if technology could be a way to channel this value of protecting and upholding and conserving the environment? And why don't I start investing in companies which are doing things which are net positive for our environment? And so that's what I started doing. And that went pretty well. We started a couple of funds. And then it was at that point that people started talking about Bitcoin. And I just was very curious to find out, was this good? Is this bad? I'm hearing different messages.
Okay. Interesting. Well, I guess we could just you really softballed it right in there if you want to go into talking about precisely what that work was. Cause if I remember correctly, you really kind of pierced the veil into the Bitcoin community and the energy and the ESG topic, maybe 2-3 years ago?
Yeah, about 2 years ago. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Do you want to go in and talk about that? Because you mentioned when you were talking with Walker on his podcast, specifically you're having the ESG exposure and background, it made a lot of us listen to you a lot more, even just beyond the fact that because Bitcoiners, I'm sure you've noticed, tend to have a little bit of a problem of as long as somebody's talking positive and the affirmative about Bitcoin, everybody rallies behind them. But you have the ESG background, which makes it more of okay, he's coming from almost essentially like the enemy side at that point when you came into the zeitgeist or the sight picture. It just made it so it was actually less of an echo chamber situation and more of like, hey, this guy's from outside, like let's pull him in and like use his voice. So can you talk about what exactly it is that like you specifically have been focusing on?
Yeah, I think that's right, because I was pretty late onto the Bitcoin scene. It really only happened a couple of years ago, and I got interested in Bitcoin mining before I got interested in Bitcoin. So for about a year, I didn't really know anything about Bitcoin. All I knew about was Bitcoin mining, because that was the, and it's like everyone gets into Bitcoin for different reasons at different times, and they have different entry points. So the rabbit hole I went down was a Bitcoin mining rabbit hole. And it's only very recent that I've found out more about the benefits of Bitcoin as sound money. So I yes. was not even looking at that stuff. So I was only looking at Bitcoin mining. And so what I looked at was I just kind of remember putting everything aside. And for about 2 months, Andreas Antonopoulos has this experience where he said he just went kind of feral. And he just put everything aside. He just lived and breathed Bitcoin. I kind of did something similar but for Bitcoin mining, where I just became absolutely fascinated because it brings together maths and physics and chemistry and economics all together. And the way that my brain finds enjoyment from things, I like the intersection between these different overlapping ideas, where you can't just stay in a single swim lane. You can't just look at it from a purely economic lens or a purely chemistry lens or a purely physics lens or purely engineering lens or purely environmental lens. Nor can you look at Bitcoin and you can say, okay, it uses emissions, therefore it's bad. Because if we had adopted that same logic with the solar industry, we would have banned solar in the 1990s or the 1980s or the 70s or the 60s, because solar was net polluting for about 40 years, perhaps 50 years of its history, because it took a lot of energy and a lot of coal to melt the silicon to 1414 degrees under these big furnaces. And at that stage, it wasn't really creating a lot of benefit because it took a long time for solar to become efficient enough that it could offset those emissions it was creating. So the first thing I said was, you can't just look at a technology and say it creates emissions, therefore it's bad. We would ban every technology if we said that. You've got to look at both sides of the ledger. So let's look at it objectively. What are the negative externalities? What are the positives? And no one was doing that. No one was saying, what are the positive externalities? And I found there was a whole bunch of them. And they said, okay, well, let's quantify these externalities. Let's quantify what's the evidence. What evidence is there? And I heard a lot of claims that it can help to build out renewables. And I said, well, how much renewables? How much more profitable can it make them? And then some other people said, well, some of these models we have of Bitcoin's energy sources, they're not accurate. I said, well, how do you know they're not accurate? What's the evidence? So I just really asked a lot of questions. I doubted everyone. I doubted people in Bitcoin. I doubted people who were attacking Bitcoin. And I said, show me the data. Show me the data. And a lot of the time, the data would come from places such as, I'll give you an example. So Cambridge. Today,
Cambridge Analytica.
Yeah, so this is Cambridge Center for Alternative Finance.
Okay, yeah, sorry.
And so they publish, or have done for a long time, some models on Bitcoin's energy use and its emissions. And I looked at their data, and to start with, to be honest, I was a little scared. I was thinking, who am I to challenge Cambridge, one of the world's top universities? But then I remembered, people are just people. People can make mistakes. Yep. People can have models that lose tune over time, even if they're good to start with. And that's exactly what had happened. They had a model, which was a good model at the time, but over time, it had lost tune. Over time, it had stopped accurately representing the Bitcoin network. And two examples. So their model, what I found was that, number one, it hasn't been updated since January 2022. So it's significantly out of date, and the world has completely changed. Back in January 2022, Kazakhstan had 13% of global hash rate. Today, according to BitRiver data, it has less than 1%. And that is a massive bearing on the data you pull in, because Kazakhstan is mainly fossil fuel. And so if it's 13%, that's going to really skew your model compared to if it's only 1%. And that's just one example. And then another example was they said, well, we don't include off-grid mining. And I was like, what? To give you an analogy, that's like saying, you've commissioned me to run a poll of who's going to win the next presidential race, and I say, well, I'm only going to survey urban voters because it's too hard doing rural voters. It takes too much time. Now, obviously, that's going to completely skew the poll results. And similarly, the patterns of people who mine on-grid versus off-grid are completely different. Because what I found was that the people, and it wasn't me who found this, it's been widely known, but I just kind of raised attention to it, was that if you're mining off-grid, the reason you're mining off-grid is what? What do all miners need? Cheap electricity, right? And today, most cheap electricity comes from sustainable sources, probably about 80%. So therefore, if you're mining off-grid, there's a very high probability you're using some sustainable power source. So if your model doesn't include off-grid miners, that's a massive inherent bias in your model. And I found that, and there was no shortcut, I just had to quantify all the different Bitcoin mining companies that were around. And I found that 30% of the entire network was mining off-grid, and they were using 75 to 80% sustainable energy. And you factor them into your model, and you get completely different outcomes. And then I published the model and put the methodology there, made it transparent, said, hey, look, you're welcome to criticize if you can improve it. If you know some data I don't know, please share. And people did. A lot of people said, no, I think this is overcooked. I think this is undercooked. Some people put their hand up and said, you've missed out about five companies. Then had to go through a process of, you know, making sure that the data that they said was actually correct data. So it took a long time, but over time we built up this picture of a more up-to-date and a much more accurate picture of Bitcoin. What it showed us very clearly was two things. Number one, that it had already become more than 50% sustainable, which was the threshold at which Elon Musk said Tesla will start accepting Bitcoin again. And number two, that its emissions as a network had not increased across a four-year period, which is incredible because every other industry that I know of, more economic activity drives more emissions. Bitcoin, you've had rising hash rate. In 4 years, it's probably quadrupled or more.
Yep.
You've had rising price, probably quintupled or more in 4 years. But emissions has not gone up. And that's because machines have become more efficient and miners have moved to more sustainable sources of electricity. Not because they're trying to be good for the environment, but simply because it happens to be cheaper. And that's only going to increase with time. And as I started to put out these messages, no one could really contradict it because, you know, it was based on sound analysis. I didn't have any vested interest. I was just curious to see what the true state of the network was. The model methodology was transparent. And it told a very different story than what we had been led to believe for a long time. So that was the first thing. And then on top of that, I started just to talk to a lot of people in the Bitcoin mining industry and just ask them just questions in ignorance and ask some pretty ignorant questions because it's a complex industry. These people knew a lot more about it than I did. And I thought, well, if I'm going to write about this industry, then I've got to find out about this industry. I've got to learn about it. I shouldn't be making statements about it until I've done probably at least a few months of analyzing how it works and understanding its economic models and its inbuilt incentives. So I'm in a position to know whether it is going to stabilize grids or destabilize them, whether it is going to incentivize, you know, one type of energy over another, whether it is going to be net decarbonizing to grids, and whether it is going to raise prices for normal residential users or increase them.
We have a audience question that it says, Matthew J says, is it true that Bitcoin is the greenest industry? And kind of whether or not that's true or not, I'm also wondering, like, as you're updating this information and, you know, you're saying it was outdated because it was 2 years ago, it almost seems like the time that it would take to collect all this information, by the time you've done that, that it's already like, well, you got to start at the drawing board again. It's like painting the Golden Gate Bridge. You got to start all over because things, so I could see how like something that potentially is a green or one of the greenest industries would also be changing so rapidly, it'd be hard to keep up with this kind of data.
Yeah, so it's a dynamic model. So every month I'll update the data. I'll take in, you know, new hash rate that's coming on board. I'll update it. The charts that we have, which I put together with Willy Wu, They're updating on a daily basis, so they're taking in energy calculations. They're actually taking in Cambridge's energy data because Cambridge had very good energy data now. The problem is with the minor data that they lay over on top of that, but the core energy data is now correct. So, yeah, it is constantly updating on a regular basis. Is it the greenest industry? Well, it depends what you mean by green. If you mean, does it have the highest percentage of sustainable energy use of any major global industry? Absolutely, it does, by an order of magnitude. It has, so now we're at 55% sustainable energy compared to banking, which is one of the next highest because it's mainly used in the grid, more like 38% or 39%. So it's significantly higher than industries which it is obviating or partially obviating. If you look at gold, for example, so Bitcoin has these two functions. Well, it has many functions, but simplistically, it can either be a store of value or can be a form of. And so the currency function, that is partially obviating the need for banking. I can use my Lightning wallet and I can transact freely and I don't need a bank to do that. I can be my own bank. So that's obviating the need for the banking sector. And I can also use it as a store of value, which means I don't have to own gold as a store of value. I can own a much more sound monetary asset. And so if you compare it to banking, it's using way more sustainable energy than banking. And if you compare it to gold, gold's terrible for the environment. It uses about 88% fossil fuel. And that's not even counting the cyanide and the mercury poisoning that it leaves in its wake as it rips down jungles around the world, legally and illegally, to extract some asset from the ground, only to have it stored in these big vaults where you never see it for the most part. And I know because I used to own gold and I actually sold it because I saw a documentary about how devastating it was to the environment. I sold it the next business day. So yes, Bitcoin is more sustainably powered than any other industry on the planet, and it is more sustainably powered than other industries that is helping to obviate. And this is a really important message because sometimes people say, well, yeah, sure, it's 55% sustainable, but it's still using 45% fossil fuel. And I say, well, what's your alternative? You know, Bitcoin's not doing something useless. That's only an argument if you think Bitcoin has no value other than as a speculative asset, which unfortunately is what most people believe because the mainstream media has not been very proactive at letting people know its value. So if you have a mainstream media source, which is number one, not telling you what the value of an asset is, and then number two, feeding you old data or bad data or misleading information about its negative environmental impact, then you get this picture of something which has no value and a negative environmental impact. Of course, you're probably, a lot of people are going to be against it, but it's a false picture. And the moment you start to understand its utility, start to understand it can replace and be better than banking rails in many cases, can be a better store of value than gold. And that's not even counting all the utility it has in the developing world, which is just gargantuan and affects hundreds of millions of people. And you start to realize this is a revolutionary technology with so many benefits. And you're telling me that here's the real amazing thing. I can't think of a technology in the world where the means of producing the thing has inherent value. I'll explain what I mean. So let's take a shoe, for example. Now, we all agree you're probably wearing shoes right now. So that's a pretty good
indication. How'd you know?
What's that?
How'd you know?
Just a wild guess. Just a wild guess. Just a wild guess. call me prophetic. So that you're wearing shoes is a pretty good indication that shoes are valuable. So we can all agree on that. But I don't think anyone here would claim that the factory in which the shoe is produced has value to you other than producing that asset, right? It has no independent value to humanity other than its purpose to create a shoe. Well, Bitcoin mining is the method to produce Bitcoin or the method to validate Bitcoin, which then results in new Bitcoin issuance, to be precise. And that has inherent value to humanity. That has value because it can provide energy security to nation states. It has value because it can be a load balancer for grids. It can help to counteract the intermittency of variable renewable energy. It has value because you can recycle the heat and use it to heat up greenhouses or tropical fish farms or to dry out timber in the timber industry, or heat up spa pools in New York bathhouses, or any number of things. Or you can use that to mitigate methane on landfills and oil fields and on farms. It just has so much utility in and of itself. So that's really quite extraordinary. So yeah, it's incredibly valuable to humanity.
My I don't know about you. Okay, so actually I'll form this in a question towards you, Daniel, but like I'll preface it by saying one of my favorite functions of Bitcoin mining is filling in that gap for the intermittent renewables that you just mentioned, right? Like, cause like one of the problems that most people don't know about is for wind and solar is that they, not only do they produce outside the peak demand window, but then there's the time during the night or during weather when the sun isn't shining and the wind isn't blowing that like, they're not like, there's no justification to keep them going. Right. So what is of those functions you just listed, pose two questions. What is your favorite and which one do you see is going to be the like an explosion in value or like adoption going into the future? Because I could see a couple.
If you have a lot of variable renewable energy on your grid, such as wind and solar, you better have a user of that energy who is very flexible.
Yeah.
It's like if you want to have an inflexible energy user, you need to have a super flexible energy producer. And the energy producers that are flexible, that's coal, that's gas. Because they can be ramped up and ramped down very quickly to meet demand. So if you have a peak event, you can ramp up, you can put more coal on the fire, so to speak. You can't do that with solar. You can't suddenly create more sun. You can't remove the clouds and create more sunlight. You can't suddenly blow into the turbines and create more wind. So you're limited. And not only can you not ramp it up, but you're at nature's mercy about whether the sun goes behind a cloud or whether the wind dies out. So that's, if you want to have inflexible uses of power, that's the worst sort of energy from that point of view. So grid owners are constantly battling with these competing needs where, on one hand, they want to decarbonize the grid. But even more than that, like if you look at the name ERCOT, the Energy Reliability Council of Texas, it's called Energy Reliability Council. It's not called Energy Decarbonizing Council. It's not called Energy Profitability Council. It's called Energy Reliability Council. So their number one mandate is to keep the grid reliable. In other words, it doesn't go down, it doesn't black out, it doesn't brown out. Because if the grid blacks out, businesses go down and people can lose their lives. And we saw that in the winter storms in Texas in 2021, when that's exactly what happened. Billions of dollars worth of damage and loss of life. You have people who or life support who are dependent upon that power, suddenly they don't have it.
Yeah.
So there's been pretty severe consequences. Now, as a grid owner, if you're putting more renewable variable power, so I'll make the distinction here. If it's hydropower, that's okay, because you can ramp that up and down, right? You can choose how much to release, but you can store it. You can't store sunlight. You can put in a battery, sure, but batteries are expensive and they only give you 4 hours. So what you need is you need people to be very flexible. So if suddenly there's a whole lot of people, let's say there's a peak weather event. So it's really, really hot. There's a heat wave and everyone comes home from work. And what do? Straight away, turn on their aircon.
Yep.
So it's really hot. Everyone's turned on their air conditioning at the same time. And let's say that even though it's really hot, it's also really still. So there's not a lot of wind. So now the grid owner is freaking out and they're saying, man, what am I going to do? Demand is peaking like this, but I only have so much supply and I don't have enough thermal energy, coal or gas, to be able to meet that demand. What am I going to do? Well, there's one or two options. Either they have this thing called a gas peaker plant they keep in reserve just for these peak weather events. And they will ramp that gas peaker plant up and that'll provide more energy. Problem averted. And the other solution is they ramp down the consumption of energy. So they've got to have a whole lot of people they can call on straight away. You can say, hey guys, we're stressing out here. We're about to have a brownout. If we don't do something soon, can you please curtail your energy? And they'll say, yep, we'll do that. And the reason they'll say, yes, we will do that is not only because they're good citizens, but also because the grid operator will have had a pre-existing arrangement where they will be paid to provide that service to keep the grid stable. So it's like an insurance policy. So in the same time, same way you'd pay an insurance premium, you'd pay a premium to certain people who agree to be part of a program who can ramp down their consumption like that. Because obviously they're paying for energy. It's going to affect their business if they ramp down, but they agreed to do it on demand. So it's called demand response. So demand response has existed for about 40 years. It's not a new thing at all. It's recognized that in order to put more renewable energy onto the grid, we have to have more people participating in demand response programs. The International Energy Association has said we need to ramp it up by about 10 times if we're going to get anywhere close to meeting our net zero emission targets. And it just so happens that who is the most flexible customer you could possibly dream for on the grid? Bitcoin miners.
Yeah.
Why? Three reasons. Number one, they can ramp down immediately. So the users of energy who have been on these demand response programs in the past, they've been steel mills, they've been aluminium smelters or aluminum smelters, as you say in the States. But they have problems, right? You can't just switch off a steel factory. There's a whole lot of processes and steps you've got to go through first, and it takes time. So you can't do it immediately. So it's not as responsive to a grid operator. The second problem with those traditional sources of demand response is that that only gives you a window of about 4 hours. Well, what if your peak weather event lasts 8 hours? What if it lasts 12 hours? What if it's a winter storm and it lasts 70 hours? That's not going to solve it, because after 4 hours, steel starts to harden. They're going to say, we need our power back. And the third problem is that it's not precisely calibrated. So in other words, the steel factory is either on or off, and suddenly you switch off the steel factory, you lose huge amounts of power. Now you have the opposite problem. You might have not enough power, so you've got to counterbalance in the other direction. Whereas Bitcoin mining, you can precisely calibrate exactly how many miners you turn off, because it's so modular, you're exactly the right level. So it's highly responsive, it has longevity, and it has precision. And that's something that grid operators have never had before. And that's why Brad Jones, who was a former interim CEO of ERCOT in Texas, said, look, Bitcoin has been amazing for helping us counterbalance the intermittency of renewable energy. And it provides a first customer of renewable energy before they get grid interconnected. So he's seen this firsthand. It is truly amazing. And it is allowing these grid operators to build out their grid using more solar and wind than otherwise would be possible. Or if a lot of solar and wind has been put on the grid because everyone got government incentives to build solar and wind, and they all built solar and wind, and suddenly they thought, oh, we can't transport it, it's in the wrong part of the country, no one needs it here, it's all getting wasted.
Yeah.
As is what's happened in Northern Territory, Australia, and Greece, and Spain, and West Texas, same thing. You had government subsidies just to build solar and wind, but very little thinking about where it was being built and whether there was a transmission capacity to transport those electrons. And then suddenly Bitcoin mining companies were able to come in and say, well, we can help you continue to build more solar and wind than you otherwise could, because we can be a customer for the energy that would otherwise be wasted because it's at the wrong time of day when no one wants it, like in the middle of the night or in the middle of the day. And we can help those renewable operators to become more profitable because they have a customer they otherwise wouldn't. And with those profits, they can build more solar farms. They can build more wind farms. And we now have a lot of this isn't my work. My job has just been to tell the story of the work that some really smart scientists have done around the world, including Cornell University, to show what Bitcoin miners have known for a long time, like for 5 years, now the academic community is caught up and is telling the story. And all I've really done is to tell the story that the scientists are telling, that's the same as the Bitcoin miners have been telling for the last 5 years, but no one believed them.
All right, I'll take a step back, Jordan and Alex, if you want to ask questions.
Real quick, I just wanted to introduce Daniel to his new neighbor who just moved in next door, apparently. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, next door.
Yeah, you both look like you're in the tropics right now.
Oh, yeah, I'm down. apologize for my tardiness. We just arrived down here in the Florida Keys for the fourth holiday. But good to see you, Daniel. I'm really glad that you could make it to our show. Been very excited to have you on our show for a long time. In my opinion, like you hear a lot of the different types of FUD that have come out pretty much continuously for years in regards to energy usage for Bitcoin, its effects on the environment, so on and so forth. Daniel, you've been, in my opinion, probably the best counter voice to those arguments that I can think of. There are others, but you've been very consistent. The articles that you've written are very well researched. And I mean, I feel like you really can't argue with them. It's just like this is the way it is. And these are the facts. And like, if you want to argue, you're just being completely irrational. So I think you've done an incredible service to Bitcoin in general. So thanks for doing that. Was excited to have you meet the guys. I do have a question for you, if you'd like to switch gears for a second here. And that is, I wanted to get your thoughts on small modular reactors. I'm sure you've heard of these things. They're basically little nuclear plants that you can stick on the back of a truck, often in the form factor of like a truck trailer. And they produce, I don't know, somewhere between 10 and 25 megawatts of power. Some of them maybe more. What are your thoughts on these things? How far out are they? Do you see economic reasons why they might be used here in the near future?
You know, the nuclear industry is something that hasn't really innovated a lot in quite a number of decades. And so now it's starting to innovate again, which is great. I haven't looked into it too deeply, to be honest. So I'm watching this with interest. And I think the more modular we can get with our power, the better, though. There's a lot of people who are generally saying that this paradigm we've had of building out these massive grids and massive power producing facilities doesn't really map onto the way that people are wanting to use energy these days, and that microgrids are more of a solution. And so the more we can modulize any sort of power, I would say the better. And look, the same thing is happening. That was the advantage I was pointing to with Bitcoin miners as a consumer of power. They're very modular, which means you can precisely calibrate how much power you use. So if you have more modular producers of power and more modular consumers of power, both of whom are very flexible, then you got flexibility on both sides. That's good, because most times in the world, grids have to be overbuilt. And the more renewables you put on them, the more you have to overbuild them, because you have to work out not for an average condition, but the time when suddenly there's no sun and there's no wind to speak of, and you need to overbuild them with other forms. So the more precise we can get, the more reliable we can get with supply of energy, the more we can ramp it up and down on a dime, and the more we can do the same on the consumer side as well, then we just have much more stable grids generally. So I'm a big fan of any sort of power generation or grid architecture which is more modular and more decentralized and more distributed.
That modularity is also why the oil and gas industry loves Bitcoin mining so much too, because the flow of the natural gas is not consistent like a lot of us would like to fantasize it is. So that's a good point.
Yeah. Have you guys talked about the use of landfills for capturing the methane yet?
No, but we can.
This is one of Daniel's specialties. Daniel, I understand that you are part of CH4, and you guys and you are basically involved in the business of capturing methane that's escaping from landfills, converting it into energy, which is then used to power Bitcoin mining. So like, you're like turning trash into wealth. It's a wild concept.
And then man.
It's very ironic because those trash pits are full of fiat nonsense, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Engine has filled them up, and now they're decomposing and making methane. Talk to us about that a little bit.
We're taking the waste from the fiat consumption fueled economy, and we're turning it into digital gold. It's pure alchemy. And if it sounds exciting, just wait till if you ever have the chance to be on a landfill. Okay, it might not sound like the most exciting place in the world to be, but I tell you, If that landfill has a power generation facility, and then you add to that power generation a Bitcoin mining hash hut, then if you like engineering, and if you like the intersection between engineering and physics and math and economics, then you'll be in your happy place, because you see all of those things just coming together. And waste, you get this methane, because methane exists when things, organic matter, decays without air. And so there's these tremendous amounts of methane that are produced from landfills, because all this organic waste is highly compacted, so it doesn't get enough air, and so you get methane released. And a lot of the time that just goes straight into the environment, which is 84 times more warming than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. Plus, it's really bad for human health. About 1 million people, according to the UN, die every year prematurely through chronic methane exposure. And it stinks. And I was literally contacted by someone who owned a landfill who was looking at a Bitcoin mining solution, not because of the economics, not because it was good for the environment, but he owned property nearby, and he realized that if he could stop the landfill smelling so much, his property prices would go up. So people get interested in this for all sorts of different reasons, I'm finding. So we're not doing the mining ourselves. What we're doing is we're providing the infrastructure financing for the smart Bitcoin mining companies who have worked out that it's a great idea to find the cheapest power you can possibly find. And if you can find stranded energy around the world, that is often the lowest cost power you can ever find, because no one can otherwise use it. So with landfills, sometimes you can sell power to the grid, but most of the time you can't. Most of the time the grid will not be able to handle that power. The landfill is in too remote a place, or you need a major substation upgrade for the grid to be able to handle that excess power, which means that in order to take that landfill gas and do something with it, you've got to do it on site. And I don't know about you, but I don't imagine you want to set up your studio in a landfill. I don't know too many people who want to set up their storefront on a landfill. I don't know too many people wanting to build residential apartments or hospitals on landfill. For some reason, it doesn't seem to be a very attractive place to people.
For some reason.
I can't imagine why not.
Snobs.
But, you know, Bitcoin mining companies, they're not fussy. They will go wherever there's cheap power. And that's exactly what they've done. And the reason they're doing it is not simply that they don't mine the landfill gas, it's because, which they're ending up destroying anyway, it's because that it makes economic sense. When 80% of your operational costs are power, which is about where they are for Bitcoin mining companies, then you will pay the extra money to collect gas out of a landfill. You will pay the millions of dollars for a whole lot of generators. You will pay for the inconvenience of being remotely located. If you're a traditional data center with only 30% of your costs being power, it doesn't make sense. You're not going to see a return fast enough. So again, this accidental coincidence of the economics of Bitcoin mining mean that whilst there are lots of people who could potentially, theoretically, do something with the landfill gas, they can't do it profitably. And Bitcoin mining companies are the only ones who can. So suddenly you have the solution for a major health hazard and a major environmental pollutant in Bitcoin mining, which is this phenomenal environmental benefit. And the thing that really blows me away is because methane is such a potent, strong greenhouse gas, then you only need 35 landfills that are venting their emissions of a mid-size, and you put Bitcoin mining projects on those 35 landfills, you've offset the emissions of the entire Bitcoin network.
What?
That's wild.
Three in the world.
A couple of follow-up questions here. Number one, how much power do each one of these sites potentially produce? So they're all of different sizes. They're going to be producing a certain amount of methane. How much are we talking about here in power terms? And then on top of that, what do the power contracts look like with these? That, I mean, I know this is a new thing, it's a new industry basically, but like, what is the cost of power for Bitcoin miners? Because I know that's a super important factor in their business models.
Cost of power is 1 cent per kilowatt hour or less.
What?
So you're getting super, super cheap power. Yep.
He said 1 cent.
1 cent. 1 cent per kilowatt
hour. Gary Cardone might want to talk to you guys. But he has specifically said he wants sites under 4 cents.
Yeah. Now, it is under 4 cents, but you've got to factor in some other things, your additional costs. Okay. Because unlike getting a power purchase agreement from a grid operator, or unlike doing hydro mining in Paraguay, you're going to have to pay for a generator, and you're going to have to pay for gas capture and collection. Okay. When you factor those things in, it's going to cost a little more. It'll still be under 4 cents, but it's going to be, your effective cost of power is going to be a lot more than 1 cent.
That's still very impressive.
But it's still pretty good. And you're also going to earn carbon credits.
Yeah.
Because you are destroying what's called carbon equivalents and methane, and every methane molecule that you destroy is worth 28 times as if that had been carbon dioxide. And the carbon dioxide that is produced through the generator, that's something that would have been produced by waste anyway, because it's organic decomposition. So it's part of the natural carbon cycle. So that's the first thing. In terms of the size of these landfills and power, so to give you an example, where I used to live until recently, a place called Auckland, 1.6 million people. There are two landfills. Each services half the population, so just under a million people. I visited one of the landfills, and it generates enough power for 16 megawatts, which is enough to power 16,000 households.
Holy crap.
16 megawatts. Now, not all the landfills that we're looking at will be that large. Some of them will be a lot smaller. And we're factoring in, if you do landfills that are half that size, so about 8 megawatts, you only need 35 of them if they're venting their emissions currently straight into the air. And that's what takes the Bitcoin network to emission negative. We're not going to start as big as that. We're going to start smaller. So we're going to start on some around 2 megawatt plants, and then we're going to suddenly build up to larger ones. But our goal is that we want to be doing sites that might have 20 megawatts or more, and tackling some of the hardest, they're not even landfills, but open dumps, which have additional complexities in developing countries. So places like India, Pakistan, Southeast Asia, Africa, who have incredible environmental challenges with their landfills. But that's, we don't want to get ahead of ourselves. They have some significant additional complexities. Our goal is to learn first on modern landfills, smaller landfills, and then gradually build up. And as we learn more, tackle some of these bigger challenges. The cool thing is that it makes economic sense as well. Like, you might think, well, that's all very noble, but how can you run a business? How can you run a profitable fund around it? Well, incredibly, because we're not only the Bitcoin mining companies who we finance, they will not only be earning revenue from Bitcoin mining, but from carbon credits. It makes sense. And the thing about carbon credits is, if you tackle harder problems, such as how do you mitigate the landfill waste from a place in Africa, and at the same time, they'll have rubbish pickers who are on the landfill who are earning their money by basically selling whatever they can scavenge. And in many cases, they're getting syringed, they're getting illnesses, they've got chronic methane exposure, so they've got upper and lower respiratory illnesses. You can take those people, give them proper protective clothing, give them a meaningful living wage, and set up a recycling factory or processing unit for them, which is basically a big shed where they can properly segregate rubbish, pay them better than they were getting. You can do all of that, and the project has such incredible social on top of environmental good, that the additional revenue you earn in carbon credits is enough to pay off the additional cost and enough to counteract the additional complexity. So incredibly, it's one of these occurrences where doing the right thing also makes really good economic sense as well, which it has to if you're going to scale this sort of project.
Alex, I know Alex is on a constricted timeline here, and he wanted to jump in with a little something. So if Alex, if you want to take that opportunity, go for it, man.
Yeah, I'll just say a couple of quick words here. It's looking like I'm going to get a remote update on my laptop from work. Right in the middle of our podcast. So before I get before that happens, I just wanted to really thank quick thank you, Daniel, for being here. I'm sorry I'm not going to stay for the whole pod, but I'm really glad that you made it. I also wanted to say a couple of quick words. Tomorrow, obviously, is the 4th of July in the United States of America. This is what we now call Independence Day. This is basically commemorating the independence of the United States of America. And I know a lot of us here from BV, I think I speak for a lot of the BV guys, that freedom is very important to all of us. It's one of the main reasons that we're part of this mission. And I just want everybody out there to know that, like, Bitcoin Veterans is all about taking guys who signed the dotted line, agreed to go overseas, do things that our country asked us to do, who have found out that the better way to serve mankind is through Bitcoin. And so that's what we're doing. That's what we're focused on. And I encourage you guys to all get involved. There's lots of cool stuff that we're doing in Nashville coming up. Next week on the pod, we've got Jeff Booth coming. That's going to be super exciting. So hook up with us for that. That'll be on Thursday night. Anyway, I appreciate all you guys. And that's all I'm going to say because I'll probably get cut off here soon.
And he's gone.
I actually, Jordan, do you have any more questions about like the energy stuff?
You look like there's something on the tip of your mind, Mike. So go for it.
I was like, Alex provided a perfect segue into a topic that is not Bitcoin centric, and we were talking in the post pregame to the actual show that we a lot of people enjoy the podcast because we don't just talk just Bitcoin, right? And we've been like largely a lot of like energy centric stuff, which is still kind of like tangential but segregated from Bitcoin. Daniel informed us in the pregame that he has some experience with some stuff that involves soldiers, if I'm not mistaken, Daniel, the way you're talking about it, in a very like separate kind of way. Daniel, did you want to talk about that a little bit? Because it sounded very interesting. It sounded like meditation is what it sounded like.
Yeah, that's a component of it. And it's been extremely, so I've been teaching meditation for about 16 years now, and also different breathing techniques. And it's something that I learned a number of years ago because I was going through some pretty strong stress. Someone said, come to this breathing course. I said, I don't need to learn how to breathe. I already know how to do that. Thank you very much.
You sound like a vet.
No, that's good. This will be great for you. It'll help you de-stress. And I really wasn't that keen, to be honest, but I went to an intro talk because she was persuasive. And I remember the introductory talk. The introductory talk, there was this woman who was giving the talk and she was talking about removing stress. And I wasn't really that interested because it just wasn't something that was on my radar. I had some stress, as I said, but I wasn't really actively looking for any solutions to it. But what happened by accident was much more interesting to me. And that was that her husband was supposed to show up to look after her 3-year-old child, and he didn't show up until about 5 minutes after she started her talk. And by which time, of course, she was wedded to mama's side and wouldn't leave her. So she was basically giving this talk to 16 people whilst also simultaneously trying to entertain a 3-year-old child who was drawing pictures saying, mommy, look at my picture. I've drawn you and all these other people and that man with the big nose and this one, she said. And suddenly I became very fascinated because I'm like, oh, this is interesting. How's this going to work out? She's giving a talk about removing stress, and she's just been placed in a situation that I'd find very stressful. And I suddenly became very interested in this talk. And I was like, wow, how's she going to do with this? But what was amazing was that, like, I had a daughter who was 6 years old at the time. And I was thinking, wow, either she's a really good actor or she knows something that I don't know how to do. Because she was switching her focus from her daughter to everyone in the room. She wasn't getting stressed. She was being 100% present with each one. And I was like, she's good. This is he's got something I haven't got. And then she looked me right in the eye and says, so Daniel, are you going to do this course? And I was like, yeah, you know what? I am going to do it. And so I said yes to it. I did it. And it was amazing. Like I said, I wasn't looking for anything, but I was happy that I did it. It was incredible. I felt a lot calm and peaceful afterwards. And I didn't maintain a regular practice straight away, but about 3 years later, I finally did. I incorporated it into my life. And it was one of the things that got me through some really tough times when I was running a technology company, when there were a lot of pressures on me, when there were pressures between me and co-founders, with investors. When you're running a company, you're a founder, you're the meat and the sandwich, and you feel like a lot of people go into business and say, oh, I want to go into business for myself because I don't want to report to anyone. It's like, then you end up reporting to more people than ever. You're reporting to everyone, your customers, your stakeholders, your shareholders, your board, your advisory board, your founders, your team, everyone. And but that really helped to get me through. And then years later, I started teaching it. And it's also taught with the military, with veterans as well. And a lot of great work has been done. It's called the Art of Living Foundation, and it's done quite a lot of work in the US with veterans returning with stress, with PTSD, which I think I actually had. I wouldn't have acknowledged it, but some things happened in my life, which it was undiagnosed. But I look at the symptoms now and think, yeah, I'm pretty sure that that's what I had. Panic attacks, waking up at night, all sorts of things, anxiety, you name it.
Yeah, sounds like it.
All those things, all of the above, that happily are no longer part of my life. But I've also found it's been really valuable because when you do the sort of work that I do and you're putting out research which contradicts the mainstream narrative, you're going to get attacked. And there's been people who have attacked my work and have attacked my integrity and have said, oh, you're probably just some bag holder is doing it to, all sorts of things get thrown at you. And for me, having something such as a breathing technique and a meditation technique has been what's made the difference. It's been what's allowed me to just keep on searching for truth and not get distracted by all the noise and stay focused on the signal. So it's something that I'm still very passionate about. I still teach and I still share with people wherever I can. I share with clients who I coach just as a technique, which is just super valuable, particularly if you're doing something which is going to place you in environments which are going to be challenging, let's say. Or you've been placed in environments in the past which are challenging and you're still dealing with some of the residual evidence of that, as I was when I first had done that.
Are you comfortable like discussing like the basics of it? Like, is it Wim Hof breathing? Like, it sounds like it's Wim Hof or something close to it.
Yeah, so I've done the Wim Hof technique. Wim Hof, I would describe as it's amazing. That's more, I would say, oriented. Yes, it's great for the mind. It's fantastic for the body. So if you want to do things like you want to go and like icy cold conditions, you want to learn how to hold your breath for 6 minutes, underwater, do Wim Hof. It's amazing. If you're more interested in using the breath as a tool to gain calm, to gain clarity of thought, to make better decisions, to improve your communication, because your communication is only as good as your thought process, then the breathing technique that I've done, I think, is really amazing for them.
Okay. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, so it's something that there's actually been quite a lot of, I like to go into the research as well. There's been a lot of research done on it recently to look at how it's helped things like anxiety or depression or even de-addiction, lowering blood pressure, all sorts of things.
But really?
All sorts of things.
Okay. That's fascinating stuff, man. I might have to shoot you a DM on Twitter to see like see if I can get more precise information out of it, or even if just sending me the course so I can look into it. Like, that would be really cool.
Happy to. Yeah, it's called the Art of Living course. The technique is called Sky Breathing. And okay. It's pretty simple. Anyone can learn it. And it's, like I say, it's been something it's just a tool, takes about 20 minutes. And it's just something that sets you up really well for the day.
Well, it's perfect for our community, I can tell you that, because we got a lot of guys that are in highly stressful situations or are running away from highly stressful situations or are using highly stressful situations to run away from highly stressful situations. So they will definitely appreciate all of that, I'm sure.
With having done that, yes. Yeah.
While we all think about our breathing right now and wonder how the hell we've gone this long without knowing and being taught how to breathe, I think it's that time that everybody in the chat has been talking about and waiting for. Story time. Daniel, I don't know if you've already, I don't know if you need a minute to think of a story, if you've already got one in the Rolodex.
We'll segue in quite nicely.
Oh, well.
So, yeah, happy to share.
Oh, yeah, everyone is excited.
Best story time guest we've had. You were just like, nope, I'm ready. Like, one in the chamber, let's go.
Well, at the beginning, you're kind of saying, ask me questions about my work. And I said, look, for me, I never really planned to have a following or anything like that. I just wanted to ask and answer some questions for myself. And I feel like a lot of things I've done in my life, I've just stumbled into it. Like, I honestly feel there's people who are better analysts than me. There's people who are better communicators than me. But for some reason, I don't quite know why, I just happen to be at the right time in history with the right question around Bitcoin and energy, where I was one of the people who was fortunate enough to make a contribution. And that's really been a theme in my life a lot. And one of the other things that I almost feel like I stumbled into was running a technology company. And so just want to share a little story about how that all came about, because it certainly wasn't through any great, I think, business acumen on my part or any great communication skills. So this is back a few years ago. So I was based in New Zealand, and I had this opportunity to go to San Diego to pitch for capital. And it was a great opportunity. We had a startup company that had created a niche product for molecular biologists that we thought could make some. The story ended up going pretty well, and we exited the company, and it's now changed how molecular biologists do research and a lot of cool things. But back in those days, it was much less certain. And so I went to San Diego to pitch to these investors, and I had my pitch ready, and I still remember going into that meeting room in San Diego, and I opened the room, and I was dressed in my suit, you know, black kind of high button suit, and everyone else was in Hawaiian shirts and board shorts, and they just laughed at me at what I was dressed in, and I kind of put aside my dressing faux pas and began my pitch. And it, you know how sometimes you visualize an outcome that you want to achieve, like you see it in advance. So I'd read about that's a good idea. So I'd visualize this outcome in my mind. And I
manifestation.
Yeah, that's yeah. So I was like, I'm going to visualize the outcome I want. This is going to be great. And so there was this guy, his name was Jay Coonan. And kind of a short guy. He's told me I can tell the story. So he's fine with it.
Okay.
Kind of look like a, do you know the movie director Peter Jackson?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it kind of looked a bit like a shorter version of Peter Jackson with a beard and earnest look. And I focused on him, and I imagined him saying, that was great at the end of my pitch, and then saying, let's talk about investing. So I visualized that in my mind. Anyway, so this is how it went. So I finished my pitch, and everyone's completely silent. And then this guy, Jay, he's wearing these glasses. He leans over his glasses. He looks at me, and he says for the word, was that it? Thinking, Jay, that's not what you're supposed to say. All three words do. And you think about it, that's kind of the worst bit of feedback you can ever get. It's like saying, not only was your pitch terrible, but it didn't even feel complete. You didn't even get criticized, but that didn't stop him, and it didn't stop the others either. And then all the questions started coming. You know, how are you going to protect your intellectual property? What's to stop a Silicon Valley company going faster than you? You know, what validation have you done that, you know, your users really need it? And I was like, yeah, that's a great question. Look, I'll get back to my technical team. I'll give you an answer, which is great to use once. But if you have to use it three times in a row, you start to lose the credibility pretty fast. So I started to roast in that suit. And I did get two compliments. I got two compliments. The first one was the program director himself, who said, well, Daniel, I'm surprised and impressed that you're still standing. And then
that's a compliment.
Wasn't really a compliment, but I'm taking it as one. And then Jay, he looks at me and he says, well, Daniel, I like you, but I really didn't like your pitch.
No compliments on the suit? That's rude.
Exactly. So anyway, I walked away, and I'll be honest, I felt pretty crushed.
Yeah.
I felt pretty crushed. And I still remember getting back on the plane and going back, and I had this mentor at the time. His name was Ricky. And he called me Cuz, and he said, so Cuz, how did the big pitch go? And I said, well, and I told him, and I never forget what he said, you know, right after he finished laughing at me.
Solid mentor.
He said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, well, you know what? I started to reverse the trend. I was like, well, you know, I don't think maybe this is as far along as I thought it was. I think we need to do some more work. I think I'm just going to put it on the back burner. Still work on it, of course, but I need to focus on some other projects to stay. And he just cut me off. He said, Cuz. He said, this is all I've heard you talk about ever since I met you. He said, this dream is your baby. And you don't put your baby on the back burner. He said, you're taking this criticism as an indictment of failure, not a recipe for future success. I'm like, yeah, that's good, Cuz. That's right. Yeah, I am. I'll remember that next time. He said, right, so here's what you're going to do. You're going to pitch again. You're going to listen to the feedback they gave you. You're going to apply that feedback, and you're going to use it to get better at pitching. And I'm like, I really didn't want to do that, but I'm like, all right then.
Yeah.
And so I did. And I pitched again, and it went a whole lot better because I only got about 10 minutes of negative feedback, not 20. I still didn't get any money. And then I pitched again and again and again. And every time it was still the same result, but it was getting a little bit better. I could feel that my ability was improving because every time I got that criticism, I was using that to improve performance, not as a reason that I was not equipped to pitch. And then 9 months later, almost to the day, we became 9 months later. That's how long it took. Okay. We became the first company in New Zealand to raise angel investment from a accredited angel investment group.
That's badass.
So we got there, and years later, I actually wrote a book on pitching because I figured that not having any natural skills in it at all, that forced me to be good at learning the process. I learned the hard way that we actually have much more capability inside us than sometimes we give credit for. And so what I took away from that is just how often, like I would have given up. You know, this is not a story about me being a hero here. If it hadn't been for the right intervention, the right words from one person at the right time, I would have given up.
In the first minute.
And how often do we do that? How often do we give up in life when we don't get the feedback we want first time or second time, or it seems too hard? How often do we let our ego run the show, not our desire for improvement? And it was really only thanks to having that right person there at the right time, reframing what I'd heard and seeing that as something I could use, that caused me to continue with that company. And otherwise, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing today. I wouldn't have run climate tech companies. We wouldn't have had the exit with the business. And I certainly I wouldn't be running a third Bitcoin climate tech company. It was doing Bitcoin mining.
I would add to that too, that your mentor was willing to say what you didn't want to hear to push you to do what you needed to do.
Absolutely. And how often are we thinking that we're being kind to people by not giving them the feedback they really need, where actually that's deeply unkind because we're rubber stamping their mediocrity, or we're not
disrespectful even,
we're not pulling them up to be their best. And I'm so grateful that he cared enough about me that he risked saying something that could offend me because he cared about my growth more than he cared about how I responded to what he said.
Hell yeah.
This was this whole conversation has been great, and you are full of knowledge, but I think that your story time there was one of the most powerful stories that could be taken away from this whole conversation. I just literally got finished reading today Sovereignty by Ryan Michler, and his whole thing is like talking about continuing to push yourself, get like outside of your comfort zone. And when you fail, like learn from it, like failure is not a bad thing to learn from it. And it's just, he also talks about meditation. So it's, I feel like you just got pulled out of that book somehow and you were put in front of me in real life to like give me a real world example of it. That's really cool.
I think that's the benefit of these experiences, is that most of the good stories that we accumulate, the best stories are the ones where you're not the hero. No one wants to hear the story where you're the hero, right? Because if you already had all the answers, what have you got to contribute to someone else? People want to hear stories because they see themselves and they see their own human frailties and your human frailties. And so I always remember that any time that I'm going through a situation in life which is tough, and we've had a few lately, we've just immigrated to another country. That was not an easy process. But any time that we've been going through something that's tough, I've been saying, you know what? There's going to be some great stories that come out of this. And maybe it's going to be other people who benefit more than me. But that's not true, because, of course, you always benefit too, because going through these tough times, you get the knowledge that you can only get through going through those tough times. I had to go through that tough time of seeing my ego at play, seeing how my ego almost caused me to give up because I didn't hear the nice voices I wanted to hear of self-validation telling me I was wonderful. But I got to see, and I remember to this day, that often in life we have these choices where there's this fork in the road and we either listen to our ego, we listen to our desire to grow. And it's like, choose one. But it leads to some very different places. And the first one leads to a better place, but it's not comfortable. The second one is much more comfortable to start with, but it leads to a very uncomfortable place down the road.
Yep. And I was just going to add, when I slightly interrupted you, I was like, and the two are very rarely ever going in the same path. The ego almost never wants to admit that like it is in the weak position and willing to learn.
Yeah.
100%.
Well,
it's been awesome talking to you, Daniel. Like, Jordan, did you want to wrap up? Like, I wanted to ask you two things, Daniel, for those that are listening and for, I might have some stuff that I need to reach out to you in the future. Where can listeners find you as far as socials, and then companies or projects that think they might be like falling within your landfill domain? How can they reach out and see if like there can be something they can work with?
So first thing is, if anyone's interested in Bitcoin mining and they have no idea where to start, but they love the idea of doing it, don't talk to me, but there's a great guy called Scott Offield, who I can put you in touch with, who is brilliant at helping you get started and is passionate about helping people who want to get into Bitcoin mining get set up with the right knowledge, but also the right economic model so they don't get wrecked. If people have specific interest, if they already know about Bitcoin mining and they're interested to explore more about how you do it on landfills, then yeah, we're happy to have a conversation. We've got a whole Telegram group specifically with like-minded people who are sharing knowledge freely. We've built up some models so you don't need to start from scratch, and that's all just freely available for being part of that group. And then if you're just someone generally who is doing some cool Bitcoin mining projects, but you're either struggling to get capital or to get joint venture partners, again, our niche focus is very much just on landfills, but we do know a lot of other people in the industry. who either have can supply the capital or can supply joint ventures. So just reach out, because I do that all the time. I like just to connect people to say, hey, you should talk to this person here, because they have a whole lot of capacity, but they don't have a whole lot of sites. You have a lot of sites and a lot of local jurisdictional knowledge, but you don't have access to the same networks. Why don't you have a conversation? And then if people are just interested, I mean, X is probably, or Twitter is the best place to find me. So at DS Batten on Twitter, and ch4capital.com, that's our investment fund. And we've just started up a new research institute, which is not run by me, but I was helped establish it. That's called the Digital Assets Research Institute, da-ri.org, DARI. And that's where you can find a lot of my research, a lot of the charts, and a lot of also great research that other people have done, that we're just building a hub that's giving people this more transparent and more accurate picture of Bitcoin's true potential with energy and being a force for good with the environment.
Don't forget to plug your newsletter, Daniel. I don't want you to forget that.
Yeah, I write a newsletter as well. That's for people who want to go deeper into the weeds and get some stories. We break some cool things, such as, hey, we found out China never banned Bitcoin mining. So we do have some pretty cool stories that I tend to put there first. And that's if you go to batcoins.com, batcoins with a Z, you can find the newsletter there and you can subscribe. There's a free edition and there's a paid edition as well.
Perfect. Batcoins, for those who haven't visited it, is a fantastic website in general for mining information. Used to use it quite a bit.
Well, Daniel, this has been an awesome conversation. I feel like I've got like five other things I'd like to talk to you about, so we can either continue that offline or we can have you on another time. But thank you so much for coming on and talking with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jordan. Thanks, Mike. It's been an absolute pleasure. So thanks for having me.
It's been a lot of fun.
And everyone else, we will see you next week at our normal time. Enjoy your Independence Day for you Americans out there. And we will see you next week with guest Jeff Booth. Looking forward to it. See y'all next week. Enjoy.